If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like Arena Football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Saturday to you. It is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons, Dave Zarum this week. Lots to get to today. We will talk about the opening of spring training for the Blue Jays. First Grapefruit League game going on Tuesday. Some good news for Michael Saunders as well. Raptors get absolutely destroyed by the Wizards, by the Warriors yesterday. That first quarter was unlike anything I think I've ever seen. And a couple of news and notes from the NFL. We got Jeff Simmons in studio, so we got to throw him a bone with some NFL talk. But we start with the news of the week, the news of maybe Dave Nonis's tenure in Toronto. Not many positives to be taken from this Maple Leaf season, but if there ever was a piece of addition by subtraction, you would think it was getting David Clarkson off of this team. Getting his number off the books. Now you get Nathan Horton's number on the books, and Nathan Horton may never play another NHL game in his career, and you just hope that he has a decent life if you've read the stories about him with the back issue. But Maple Leafs trade David Clarkson to the Blue Jackets for Nathan Horton. They can put Horton on long-term injured reserve, which means his number does not count against the cap. So I don't know if this team's going to be a cap team in the next 5 years, but if they are, they have a little more wiggle room. How much credit, though, do we give the GM, Dave Nonis? Dave?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's the same guy who gave Clarkson the contract, right? So I think you kind of got to hedge any, accolades you throw in his direction because of that. Credit for getting the contract off the books, obviously. That's going to pay dividends down the road, as you just alluded to. But to me, this is kind of the bare minimum the guy could have done. I know, it must take some magic to get a team to accept Clarkson's deal based on, what we saw from the guy. But for me, this has to be the first step. It can't be even close to the last step.
And it might not even been them who actually came up with the idea. It might have been Columbus.
Yeah, totally. Because
for them, the money doesn't flow like MLSC, right?
Yeah.
So they'd rather pay $5 million for a guy who's actually playing. I think Clarkson's playing on the first line tonight. I think I saw Elliot Friedman just retweeted that he's playing with Ryan Johansson tonight. So fourth line from Toronto, first line Columbus. I guess they're getting their money's worth.
Watch. Clarkson's going to kill it in Columbus. It's just, it's going to happen.
Yeah, he's going to play alongside Foligno and Johansson tonight.
But terms of a trade, that to be one of the more surprising transactions I've ever seen.
Why?
Just because he had the NHL salary cap today, it's so hard to move contracts.
Okay.
And Clarkson has one of the worst contracts in the league in terms of production and at the time when people thought he might be okay, he was still considered overpaid, and 7 years was a bit nuts for a guy who scored 30 goals once. But he was horrible here, and it almost had to find such a unique scenario, like with Nathan Horton, to actually move this guy. But
well, that's the thing. Yeah, if you're Columbus, I mean, you're getting something for nothing in a sense, right?
Yeah, you're getting a warm body that can actually play. And if you're not going to be a cap team either way, which it doesn't look like Columbus ever will be, I mean, what's the difference? If you got a big number either way, and you don't need the cap relief of a Nathan Horton, at least you get a guy that you can actually, that can do up his skates. Like, that's not hyperbole.
Yeah.
I don't know if Nathan Horton can do that at this point. So what does it mean for the Maple Leafs in the short term, in the long term? They won immediately after trading David Clarkson. That's always the danger, right, Jeff, when you're talking about addition by subtraction? Look at what happened to the Raptors after trading away Rudy Gay.
Yeah, this could make them better, which might ruin the Connor McDavid hopes.
But although they got outshot by like 35 shots.
Yeah, the Randy Carlyle hockey was back on the last game. But I imagine they're going to try to keep making moves as Monday comes.
Well, listen, if they don't make any more substantial moves, and the deadline passes, I still think, you got to look at it as a complete total failure, don't you?
This season for the Maple Leafs?
No. Like the Leafs at the deadline. If moving Clarkson's contract is the move, I think that's not enough, not close to enough right now.
Well, I mean, that is a discussion you can have, because how many more you've moved your Daniel Winnick was a guy that had to be moved. He's a UFA. You moved Mike Santarelli a UFA. David Booth's another guy who you can move. I don't know what his value is, a guy who was hurt beginning of the season. He's a UFA. Olli Jokinen, another guy, UFA. I guess those are the guys you move. But I don't know, Jeff, would you call it a failure? Is it if Dave Nonis isn't able to pull anything else off? Because he's alluded to the fact that this might be it.
Well, I think if the fact that they moved Clarkson makes it hard for me to call it a failure, because that was so surprising. But I'm kind of with Dave that moving rental players isn't a rebuild. That's kind of what bad teams do every year.
Exactly.
For them to actually rebuild, you got to start moving core players who've been here. It might be harder with some of the salaries of Dion Phaneuf or Phil Kessel, but a guy like Tyler Bozak, a guy like Joffrey Leupold, if you're going to actually change the culture and actually rebuild the team, you can't just move the guys who probably would have left in free agency anyway.
If Bozak, Leupold, Phaneuf, the entire core, save for maybe JVR, if those guys, and I know it's probably unrealistic, but if those guys are on the team after the deadline, then I just really don't think they've done enough. And I know they're probably not going to be able to move all those guys, but it's all about the rebuild now, right? So if you're going to commit to that, do it right.
See, the hard part with that is the salary cap. And so they might want to move these guys, but they might not have a taker for some of them. So they can still move them in the summer and still kind of get the rebuild have an kind of a fresh team on the ice next year. But I think you make a very good point. They can't just...
I mean, to me, Phaneuf is a really interesting guy. I mean, because he's someone who I think other teams will look at as a guy who can come in and help. The contract is terrible, but when you look at teams kind of, you know, fighting for that playoff spot, just looking for that help on the blue line, I mean, I think he's a guy who might get targeted more than we might think. I think of like a... Maybe it's pie in the sky, but I think of a team like Detroit, maybe.
Yeah, it's not his fault. He's miscast here and he's put in a... Has to be a number one defenseman at almost $8 million a year. He's still a valuable player. It's just, he's probably not the guy you want building your team around.
Yeah, and you I think you bring up a good point, Jeff, when you say that, I mean, the offseason might be the time that you see a Dion Phaneuf, a Phil Kessel, if they trade one or both of those players. It's more difficult to do when you're trying to, and it's the team that they would be going to would be a cap team, right? We're talking about a team that's making a Stanley Cup push, that wants that extra body to get them to, you know, maybe they're on the periphery of cup contender. You would think adding a guy like Phil Kessel, that would be an over the top move, which means you're probably close to the cap and it's difficult to add that in season.
And when we look out west, you know, I think those are the teams that are really going to be looking to add on those pieces this time of year, you know, at the deadline. When you look at, I think the Patrick Kane injury really kind of, I don't know if it actually opens up things, but it might have some GMs talking themselves into it.
Another cap team, though, right? Like, they just don't have a ton of wiggle room. I guess putting him on long-term injured reserve helps, but...
Yeah, but I mean, like, I'm not talking about the Blackhawks per se. It's the teams around them. They see weakness in the West now, potentially, and then that might make GMs more, you know, more eager to go out and take the risks and take on some of the contracts of these Leaf guys. But, you know, kind of back to the Clarkson thing, one thing I was thinking about was... If the big benefit is cap room, I don't know if that's... It's obviously not a bad thing, but the way the NHL is right now, building through free agency is probably the least effective, least realistic way to get better at this point, right?
I mean, you just don't ever see good players get to free agency.
Yeah,
the guy who's on the horizon that, you know, you can't talk about the Maple Leafs and cap space and free agency without mentioning Steven Stamkos, even though it might be pie in the sky. Got another season in Tampa before he becomes an unrestricted free agent, but we keep hearing, you know, daily about the possibility of a contract offer coming from the Lightning, 8 years, $88 million, something like that. You just don't see guys get to free agency anymore.
It's because of those big long-term contracts, the 8-year, 10-year deals. I think the only way you can really build in the NHL now is through the draft or through trades. So if you're just, you know, clearing all this cap space, you know, what's it for? I mean, you look at the unrestricted free agents next summer and it's a pretty weak list. I mean, Johnny Boychuk might be the best player in that group, you know, maybe Martin St. Louis.
You mentioned trades there.
Yeah.
With the cap space, they can use that to create a trade, right? Mm-hmm. If there's teams that are trying to create cap room or there's guys who want to shed contracts.
Good point.
You can pay maybe a draft pick or other assets to use that $5 million to actually get a pretty good player. And 5 years from now or 3 years from now, even, what would David Clarkson be? So to have that space could be, even if guys don't hit free agency and Stamkos, obviously that might not happen, but to have that space could be very valuable for a team that is looking to rebuild pretty much everything they have right now.
And maybe it adds to your ability to pay your young players as well, right? Nazem Kadri is, I mean, there's going to be another discussion to be had with him. Another year of restricted free agency. Do you do another bridge deal? Do you finally get him signed up long-term? Because depends on who you ask. There's the eye test and there's the numbers, and you know, both have been pretty good for Kadri. If you're looking at positives and developments on this team, he's probably on that list of things that have gone sort of well.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the Clarkson thing, okay, we're talking about a Toronto guy who came home, and I think it was pretty telling when he was asked what his most memorable time in Toronto was. It was said, when I signed that contract, when I came home and signed that deal, because honestly, there were not, you run down the game log, there's not one moment that you can say, man, that was, at least there was like that one moment, there wasn't one for David Clarkson. Yeah. I wonder if it is, you know, does Steven Stamkos, now you can't compare the two as far as players, but is Steven Stamkos or other Torontonians looking at the way things went down with David Clarkson and saying, you know what? Well, Daniel Winnick, too, he was a Toronto guy. Again, not comparable to Steven Stamkos. But is there a possibility that there are other guys who say, you know what, maybe coming home ain't so great?
Well, I mean, what's so appealing about playing for the Leafs right now? I mean, if especially if you're a guy like Stamkos where you really can go anywhere you want, any team that's going to offer you a contract. I mean, everyone wants you on
everybody
on
says
your team.
That, but you're from here, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you want to play for your hometown team? Like, if you were a professional hockey player, wouldn't you want to play in front of your friends and family? Maybe. Wouldn't you want to take up the challenge of bringing a cup back to Toronto?
Well, I'd much rather win hockey games. I'd much rather be remembered as a winner. I'd much rather have cups to my name and things like that. And I don't, you know, you come to Toronto, I mean, there's no signs that that's going to happen anytime soon.
But you're a professional athlete, so you've got a bigger ego than even you have right now as a professional writer. So you think you're the best. You think you're the best. You think you can change the culture. You think you can bring a winner to Toronto. You think David Clarkson showed up in Toronto? Yes, and a big part of it was the big dollar signs. There were big dollar signs in Edmonton, bigger than there were in Toronto for Clarkson. But he came here because he thought, you know what, I can do something here. I can change history.
But Clarkson's not a Stamkos kind of guy. I mean,
right.
There's not going to be the same kind of, you know, fight to get Clarkson on your team. You know,
there was a fight to get Clarkson on your team.
Nothing close to what it's going to be like with Stamkos.
Sure.
I mean, we're talking about, you know, a top five player, right? And we were just talking about it before. Like, to me, Toronto, the Leafs are kind of like the Knicks right now. You know, it's this historic club. They got all this great legacy in a huge market, but it's such a dysfunctional organization with such a shoddy track record in the last few years. It just seems like such an unappealing place to spend your career.
It certainly was for David Clarkson. Things did not end very well for him. And we'll have to see if Steven Stamkos goes down that same path. On Twitter, and again, I always feel of two minds when looking at things at Twitter. One is, oh, this is an actual pretty good gauge of the temperature of you know, fans and media, and it's a good conglomeration of both. And sometimes I think, oh, it's just all the trolls. But what do we make of this? There was a little backlash to this deal, the Clarkson and Horton deal. We've seen some people call it a circumvention of the salary cap, not in the spirit of the salary cap.
What does that mean?
it's a good question. Brian Burke always talked about, you know, doing things the right way, even if it's, you know, by the letter of the law, it's allowed. I don't know if you should do it. He had his own, you know, holiday period where there was no movement. He, even though the league has one, he had his own because he felt like he could set the rules. Is there reason, Jeff, for other teams to be upset or the NHL to have a second look at how this went down? Because the Maple Leafs just used their incredible financial clout to get this done and were, in a way, able to circumvent the salary cap.
No, I don't think so. I don't know if Brian Burke's the best guy. This his policies is the reason they at least had to give up an extra first round pick to get Phil Kessel.
Yep.
They want to use that offer sheet. So I don't see a big problem with this. Columbus is happy to make this deal. They're getting something of value. The Leafs are still paying the money. And I don't see why a team would have a problem with this. It's really not circumventing the cap in my mind.
It is a situation though where they use their financial clout.
Yeah,
there's a couple of ways you can do it with the salary cap.
As they should, right? You use everything to your advantage.
Absolutely. I mean, they finally got ownership that you would have thought would have overpaid, you know, would have paid extra to land the best players, and the salary cap arrives.
Mm-hmm.
They have funneled that money towards things that they can overspend on for things that there is no cap. I mean, they have how many assistant GMs does this team have? How many scouts have they hired in the last couple of years? Finally, it seems, I mean, Dave, honestly, it seems like they're using the abilities and the assets that they have that other teams, like certainly Columbus, doesn't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And finally, yeah, there is an advantage to being a Toronto Maple Leaf.
And yeah, and for me, that's the brightest part about this this trade is yeah, you get Clarkson off the books, and that's huge. You bring on a guy who you're not going to have to pay if he's on the extended injury list, whatever it's called. But also, yeah, you see a team recognizing its strengths and kind of playing to it in the transaction market. But again, I go back to the point where I need to see more. You know, this needs to be the first move of a few before I get too excited about what the Leafs are doing right now. You know, it's just not enough to get rid of, yeah, a bad contract, but also a player who really wasn't a big part of your team. I got to see some of that core really get, you know, chopped into pieces.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. So the NHL's trade deadline goes on Monday, and Dave Nonis has kind of been coy about whether the Maple Leafs have another move in them. We'll have to see. I mean, they've done a pretty good job of sending their pending unrestricted free agents out the door. What about other teams? I mean, we've seen little moves. I mean, Jaromir Jagr is a name. He used to be a guy that could play. I mean, he's fine.
He's okay.
Panthers are on the outside of the playoffs looking in, though, and it's kind of interesting that a guy like Jagr gets a return pretty similar to what a guy like Daniel Winnick got. But it is 2015, not, you know, 1999. Do we expect a big Monday? I mean, it seems like in the last couple of years that it's the weeks or week leading up to the NHL's trade deadline where we see the most movement, which is unfortunate for the guys that show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, right, Jeff? I mean, you got a feel for our Sportsnet brethren.
Yeah, hey, usually the free breakfast.
That's true.
Usually we have a pool for when the first trade happens. And it's never before 11. It's never after. It's never before noon. So it's a long morning. And it's a long morning talking about rental players that are mostly third liners. And we said good players just don't hit free agency anymore.
But you know, just looking at, you know, was it 2 weeks ago we had the NBA trade deadline, and that was supposed to be a pretty quiet one. You kind of saw everything that was going to happen. And then suddenly the deadline came and it was just like an S storm. So I think there's some potential there, you know, to be surprised by what happens.
Who do we expect to be the biggest mover and shaker? So the Panthers are kind of a surprise. They're kind of a surprise to make an addition, right? They're 4 points back still now of the Boston Bruins. They've lost four straight. They had a chance last week with a win to surpass the Bruins and move into that second wild card spot. But they've traded away a second round pick in 2015, conditional third rounder for Jagr. Is that the first of many, Jeff? If you were going to look at in the Eastern Conference, who could be making additions? I mean, that first of all, that was I think surprising to many that the Panthers thought well enough of this team that they thought we had a legit chance to make the playoffs, make an addition. Could there be more on the horizon? Do you just double down on those moves now?
I think the team that you should watch in the East is Boston. Mm-hmm. I think you saw Florida just go get Jagr. Boston's only 4 points up on them, and they haven't been all that good this year. They got a goal differential of one. I've seen Joffrey Leupold attached to them. I've seen Antoine Vermette attached to them. I think they're the team that really needs to make a playoff push. They're the only team really in the East fighting for a spot right now. And Florida's been playing okay, but no, they lost four in a row. They're up. This is the kind of their chance to really jump in the spot, and they really haven't been that same Boston team we've been used to. And they can get some help up front and maybe some help on the back end. I can see them making moves for sure.
I think Florida's seeing how Luongo's playing for them and thinking, you know, let's capitalize on this right now. So I see them a couple more moves down the pipe. They're a team that, I don't know, Phaneuf might make sense for if they're willing to take that on, the kind of player who can kind of come in and help them in some way. I think it's pretty interesting out west. I think there's going to be a lot of buyers and sellers. You look at teams like Vancouver, Winnipeg, those teams like I was talking about, right in the playoff race, but maybe thinking that they might have a better chance now once they get into the playoffs because of Kane going down and some holes in some of the other teams out west. What do you guys think about Edmonton? Because them and Phoenix, Arizona, the Coyotes seem like pretty surefire sellers at this point. Do you see Edmonton, like, touching their core at all at this point?
Well, that, again, like, that seems like a bigger deal, right? You're going to want a huge return if you are giving up on one of those guys, whether it's Eberle, whether it's Taylor Hall, whether it's Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. And maybe, well, and you know what? Nail Yakupov has actually turned into a decent player the last couple of weeks as well. That seems like a deal that probably gets made in the offseason if they do finally decide to go that way. Calgary's kind of an interesting team,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because they're playing with house money to a degree.
And Giordano just...
Giordano just got went down.
Yeah.
So if you are the Boston Pizza Man in charge there, or your dad's the Boston Pizza Man, but you're the son of the Boston Pizza Man, and you're in Calgary, and you're the GM, or you're Brian Burke, who's overseeing the son of the Boston Pizza Man, do you see this as an opportunity, or is it kind of like it's almost a Raptors-y situation you're already, you don't want to mess with the development path that you're on. Mm-hmm. Where do you see it there, Dave?
I don't know. I mean, I like when teams recognize that, you know, we maybe didn't plan for the situation, but here we are. So let's roll with it. So yeah, Calgary right now, they're in ninth. They're tied with Los Angeles. I think we all think LA's got the edge on them in terms of the playoff hunt. But if I'm Calgary, I'm looking at the playoffs and thinking this is a distinct possibility. We've, you know, overcome all expectations this season, and maybe they're a player or two away from getting into the playoffs. And then, you know, and then it's free game. Who knows what happens from there? There's no real team in the West that really, really scares me. If I'm like a plucky, exciting team like Calgary, I think I have a chance against anybody. So I see them going for it at the deadline.
Even if you trail going into the third period, they're the best third period team in the National Hockey League. The Kings are that interesting team that we mentioned. I mean, they had won 8 straight not too long ago, lost a couple in a row now.
And they made their big move.
Right. Well, a move. Yeah, they picked up Andre Sequeira from the Carolina Hurricanes for a conditional first rounder and a prospect. And, you know, listening to some of the quotes coming out of L.A. after that deal, it's a situation where Dean Lombardi realizes, hey, you know, I know we're kind of dealing as well with house money and mm-hmm. winning a couple of cups over the last 3 years. And he felt like he owed it to that core to try and add a piece, to try and get back into a deep playoff run scenario. And Jeff, I don't know if there's a scarier team to be, I don't know, right now they're not in a wild card spot, but one of those 2-3 seeds in a division, or if it is a wild card spot, I don't know if there's a scarier team than the defending cup champs.
No, that's the last team any of these guys want to see in the first round or in the playoffs at all. And they're so battle tested. They were playing so well until this recent losing. They've dropped a couple games in a row, and just nobody wants to play LA in the playoffs. They're so hard to play on defense. When Jonathan Quick's hot, they're really good, and they're so physical up front.
Not to keep making NBA analogies, but they're kind of like the Oklahoma City Thunder in the sense that, you know, if they get in at the eighth spot, we all know that they're a better team than their rankings. So, yeah, I'm with you. That's a team I wouldn't want to face in the first round.
Except they didn't miss, like, Drew Doughty and Jonathan Quick for 2 months to start the season.
Yeah. Fair enough, yeah.
What about San Jose? They're a couple points out of the playoff spot. Their GM's kind of job might be on the line. Coach's job might be on the line. Could you see them maybe making a big move?
As buyers?
Yeah, they're kind of on the outside looking in right now.
Yeah, they're slipping away as well. The Wild have a game in hand on them in that second wild card spot, and they're 3 points up on San Jose. Just seems like a team, unlike in years previous, right, where they've dominated the regular season, it seems like they're a broken team. I don't know. For whatever reason, it hasn't worked out. And you know, Joe Thornton's another year older. They do have guys that can score. It just seems like there's not, I don't know if leadership is the right word, but something is not quite right in San Jose. We haven't heard much of them or much from them as far as acquisitions. They haven't made one yet in the weeks leading up to the trade deadline. Could be a team to watch, no question. When we come back, Blue Jays spring training rolls along. They had their first full squad workout yesterday. First game comes up on Tuesday as they will play the Pittsburgh Pirates at Florida Auto Exchange Stadium. And you can watch it on Sportsnet. Hear it on sportsnet.ca as well. Michael Saunders actually had some good news after stepping on a sprinkler or around a sprinkler and messing up his knee. And Johan Santana apparently has arrived today. He's got a locker next to Aaron Sanchez. We'll talk about it. Coming up next, this is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Arden Zwelling.
He's the guy calling out Hockey Canada after he was left off this year's World Junior team. He's the 28th overall pick, saying he'll be the best player in his draft class. He's the 19-year-old who's never played a minute above junior hockey, who says he'll score 60 points in his rookie NHL season. He's Josh Hosang, and he could be the most contentious player to reach the NHL in years. If the hockey world thinks Patrick Kane is too brash, Tyler Seguin is too self-centered, and PK Subban celebrates too much, just wait until they meet Hosang. Find out more about the New York Islanders draft pick, who's taking the hockey world by storm, in Sportsnet magazine.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. Blue Jays open up their Grapefruit League campaign on Tuesday at home against the Pirates. You can watch it on Sportsnet, hear it on sportsnet.ca. And Aaron Sanchez will actually start that game, so that'll be fun. Bad news yesterday, or a couple of days ago, I guess now, Michael Saunders had the scare where he stepped around a sprinkler and tore up his knee pretty good. There were reports that initially he would be out until the All-Star break if he was going to have that meniscus repaired in his knee. Now, things are better all of a sudden because he had 60% of that meniscus just removed. Now, things are not good for the long-term prognosis of Mr. Saunders because, I mean, he was trying to avoid this because apparently it means more likelihood of developing arthritis and long-term problems. But as far as this season, actually good news because the time frame has been moved up to now 5 weeks-ish, which would actually put him in line to start the season. But he's probably going to need a couple of weeks of either extended spring training or minor league camp or something to get his timing down and all of that. So that means no more Danny Valencia in left field or Steve Tolleson in left field or something, right? Jeff, this is it can't be viewed any other way than good news for the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah, this is a massive break for them. And they almost got to All-Star break without their left fielder. They couldn't make it to March without a major injury.
Yeah.
Which sums up the Blue Jays the last couple of years. But this is a shameless plug here. I wrote early in the week.
This whole show is a plug. You got to remember that. It's 2 hours of plugging the magazine and the website. So well, go ahead and plug away.
The timing worked out very well on this. I wrote an article earlier in the week. I talked to Mark DeRosa about their depth of the roster and kind of their bench.
I saw that, actually.
And DeRosa kind of felt like me that they were kind of weak in some major spots. One of them was their outfield depth, and one of them was their middle infield depth. And there you go. Saunders is out 6 weeks, and now they're already tested there. And Kevin Pillar is a fine player. He's could be an okay player, but to have him and Pompey starting every day, and it's pretty thin for a team that's looking to make a playoff push. And obviously, you like the moves they did at the top of their lineup, but coming into the year, there were some holes, and they have such a small margin for error in some spots. And Saunders was one of the spots we pointed to. He's got a long injury history. He hasn't even played in the turf in Toronto yet, but then now he's got the bad knee. So it's going to be tough on him, and it's tough on the Jays because they're not really built. They don't really have that fourth outfielder that's proven, and they can obviously use a veteran in that role, and they brought in Dierks, but he's got the bad back, and they signed Chris Dickerson the last weekend, so they're really thin there, and already having one guy down is pretty tough on them.
Yeah, that was kind of the worst-case scenario almost is to lose a guy like Saunders just because, like you're saying, they're so thin at that position. And it's interesting when you look at the Jays in general. I mean, you can make the argument that half their lineup is the best in baseball, and the other half is the worst. You know what I mean? There's that kind of disparity between the top four and the bottom four, top five, bottom four, however you want to split it up. So to have a starting guy like Saunders go down and have to replace with the guys you mentioned, I mean, that would really be an ugly situation for the Jays. And they're not going to be able to avoid it. Like you said, Saunders, even if he's back healthy at the beginning of the season, they're still going to give him some time to get worked in. But you need him in the fold because of the lack of depth. No question about that.
Yeah, having a guy like Pillar as your fourth outfielder with maybe a more proven left fielder, I think that's an okay scenario. Yeah. But just having the injury history of Saunders, and
yeah,
obviously it's a fluke injury, but he's already going to miss some time in April. And mm-hmm. Now you got to play two almost unproven guys at the major league level. And I'm not sure who the fourth outfielder is going to be there to fight for that spot. They're really thin at that spot. And they already have enough concerns, the bullpen, starting mm-hmm. rotation depth. So there's a lot of questions going into a team that made some pretty good moves in Martin and Donaldson, but
Yeah, like the dirty secret on this team is that there's a ton of holes still, regardless of the good moves. You know, you obviously bringing in Russell Martin, Josh Donaldson, those are huge moves, and I think we'll talk about why in a bit. But the fact that you still have these, you know, glaring weaknesses on your roster, that I think that's going to come back and bite the Jays.
Yeah, as far as bench depth, I don't know how many teams in Major League Baseball actually have guys that can just jump off the bench and be Major League ready starters, right? There's not many guys that go 13 deep far as starting, you know, position players.
Only the Red Sox.
Yeah, the Red Sox have too many outfielders, and they've got shortstops playing in the outfield. So, yeah, that's kind of a bizarre scenario. But, yeah, it's not too many Red Sox out there. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. Getting back to Saunders, though, do you believe in this notion that there are guys that are just injury-prone? We talked about how fluky this type of thing is, but it's a guy who, for whatever reason, just can't stay on the field. Is there something to be said for like a Carlo Koliakovo type?
Totally.
Guys that are just under a gray cloud their entire lives?
Totally, especially with something like the knee, and you talk about them removing the meniscus. I mean, that's something that's going to come back and haunt him too. You know, just think of like Derrick Rose is having the same issues now. You know, some of these guys,
That's the same injury over and over and over again with Derrick Rose, right? Like it's the same.
He's never hurt his knee like that?
In triple sprinkler before.
Yeah, he tripped over a sprinkler. He had the oblique problems last year where he missed half the season. This is a new thing for him. It's not a recurring thing. I mean, Derrick Rose, we're all waiting for that knee to explode, right? Like it was not a ticking time bomb for Michael Saunders.
But Rose had, you know, I think Rose had like left knee and then the right knee. I mean, he's had both knees, problems with both knees at one point. With Saunders, I mean, you know, even if it's a different injury every time, I do believe that some guys are just susceptible to that kind of thing. Maybe it has to do with you know, the recovery and the training regimen, or maybe it's just the guy's makeup. You know, I'm nowhere near scientifically adept enough to explain how that would work. Science was definitely never my strong suit, but I think there are guys who just can't stay healthy, and you hope Saunders isn't one of them, but he's showing himself to be that kind of guy.
That's kind of why Seattle was willing to move him, right?
Part of the reason why.
Yeah, his production dropped off.
Especially when he's a guy who you're counting on, you know, it's hard for those guys to be dependable.
And that's turf in Toronto is a tough thing to play on.
Yeah, and that's it. And you make a great point.
But
you know,
there's no sprinklers. There's no sprinklers
that's
on
true.
The turf.
That's true.
They better keep it off before the games, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Adam Lind, I wonder if he's laughing at this after his comments about the Blue Jays training center. Although it's pretty difficult to rip him when a guy has a fluke type of injury like that.
Even if it's not a fluke injury, I mean, you can't rip a guy for getting hurt. It's just breaks of the game.
Yeah, but you can maybe point to it being a recurring theme. And unless it's like a mitochondrial disorder like Rocco Baldelli, you wonder if some guys just have horrible, horrible luck. Also, this week, first week of Blue Jays spring training, we had some comments. Jose Bautista finally, I don't know if he was responding directly to the comments from Adam Lind talking about the leadership in this clubhouse and that Jose Bautista is still the leader of the hitters. He hasn't gone anywhere, and the Blue Jays trying to change the clubhouse chemistry and the leadership structure. Here's what Jose Bautista said this week.
You walk around after a loss of a crucial game or a bad, you know, beating that you took, and, you know, sometimes you see people and you don't know what they're thinking. I'd rather at least know. You know, I can't say that I can read minds, and I can't say that I thought that guy didn't care, but if I don't know, it makes me think. I'd rather I look at you. We got our butts handed to us 10-0 or 9-1. I'd rather be able to see you in your body language and your facial expressions and know that you're upset that we got our butts kicked, you know, which with some people in the past, I can't say that was there without naming any names. And it's not that big of a deal. It's not what led to the seasons we had. It's just something nice to see.
So Jose Bautista is basically talking about what fans talk about, which is when you lose, I want to see you upset. I don't want to see you joking around, hamming it up in the clubhouse. And I guess he didn't mention any names. He made sure he mentioned that he didn't mention any names.
Colby Rasmus.
Well, Colby seems like the most obvious guy, right? And even Adam Lind had negative things to say about Colby Rasmus. But Adam Lind, I wonder if he's in that category as well. Brett Laurie, I wonder. I mean, he's an intense guy, but
too intense.
We look at I mean, you just have to look at the guys who are no longer in this clubhouse, right? Overall, Dave, what do you make of those comments?
I don't know. I think that it kind of sounded like BS to me.
Because you know what? Jose Bautista has been criticized for the same thing.
Exactly. It's kind of like glass houses, right? But I think, you know, again, with those kind of quotes, those kind of interview scrum scenarios, I think it's just something that, you know, Bautista felt had to be said, you know, to kind of get that out there, clear the air or whatever. But I don't know how much validity there is behind those comments.
Well, there was some issues in the clubhouse last year.
And there's no question.
Yeah, and I remember Shai Davidi wrote a really good piece at the end of last year talking
about the
trust issues in the locker room. And you look, and there was just something strange about their team. And you look at the guys they got rid of. Ben mentioned it before. And they kind of are maybe are the guys that kind of were laissez-faire, or kind of the...
But the leadership group is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm still not sold on Bautista as the best leader. And
but right now he's that guy.
Yeah, he is the guy. I think having Donaldson and Martin really helps, especially Martin.
Yeah.
It's kind of one everywhere he's gone. But as you mentioned before, I'm still not sold on Bautista. I didn't like his comments after the deadline last year. I thought that was in poor taste. And
yeah, him and Casey Jansen maybe have to throw into that mix as well.
Who's he's no longer here.
Right.
Moro's gone. Melky Cabrera's gone.
But what Jose Bautista is saying, I don't know if we can put that on Casey Jansen, right? This is a guy who I think wanted to win, who never really seemed like one of those guys who was happy to lose. Mm-hmm. I would have put Adam Lind into that category. So I'll just call him laid back, right? And there's a fine line. You can have some laid back guys on your team as long as you don't have 25 laid back guys. I think it takes a mix. Now, you mentioned the leadership is still there. Jose Bautista is still there. He's, as Adam Lind said, the leader of the hitters, which makes sense. He's the best. But here comes Josh Donaldson, and sure, he's not going to lead right away. Mm-hmm. He's new to this team, a team that's been together for long enough. Here you've got Russell Martin, who, again, is not going to lead right away. But I think Martin maybe more so even than Donaldson, because he touches the ball on every play.
Yeah,
he's working with the pitchers. That could be a guy. How much do we put into, I mean, baseball, again, is, can you have 25 scumbags and win? Probably, if they're the greatest scumbags ever. But I guess if you don't have the greatest scumbags, then don't have too many scumbags, Dave. You know a thing or two about scumbags. Give us your scumbag knowledge.
Yeah, I'm sitting with two of them right now.
That's good.
No, I think, you know, it's tough. Like, your leader should probably be your best player in a perfect world, right? So if Bautista's your best hitter, that's going to be your leader. That's just kind of how things shake out. So it's part of, you know, building a team is you gotta weigh that side of thing, you know, the clubhouse side of things. And with the Jays, I don't think they're too far off. You mentioned Martin and Donaldson, and the great part about them is the fact that they're not only good baseball players, but they have the potential to be really good clubhouse guys and leaders. And I think so in that sense, it addresses two needs for the Jays. You know what I mean? So I think that's why there's a lot of optimism around those moves. It's still Bautista's team. It's still him and Edwin and the group that we saw last season, for the most part, still in place here. So I don't know how much dramatically different it's going to be, at least early on.
Yeah, and Martin already has some club with Bautista, right? They have a history together.
Yeah.
I think they played college together. So he's not going to have to fit in with Bautista and really take the time. He's kind of, I think that's the biggest reason they brought him in, other than his good catching behind the plate and his ability to work with pitchers. But they really needed a guy like that. And last year you saw it kind of crumble as the injuries happened. Mm-hmm. And I think the guys they got rid of, I think they were sold on for a reason. Alex Anthopoulos kept talking about maybe like a new culture and changing the attitude around the team. And you kind of see it with who they've brought in.
Another name that they brought in is a guy who I guess you can point to as perhaps a leader, although it's difficult as a starting pitcher. But Johan Santana, former Cy Young Award winner, he has dealt with some serious shoulder issues the last couple of years. Hasn't been in the major leagues very much. And apparently even in his rehab and working his way back to viability in the Venezuelan league, he had to be shut down as well because of the shoulder issue. But they wouldn't have brought him in if they didn't think he could pitch. And if he can pitch, Dave, I mean, that's your fifth starter.
Yeah. Well, if he's healthy, he is your fifth starter. It kind of solves that problem. But I think they're just kind of taking a flyer. I don't know what the money that he came in for. I think it's around $2 million. But
there's a bunch of incentives.
So, and that's going to be key there. I mean, I think, you know, when I was talking to Ben Nicholson-Smith about this, our trusty MLB editor on Sportsnet.ca, I think he put the over-under for 10 innings this season for Santana. So I don't think there's much in the way of expectations around him just because of all the injury problems. But it's worth taking a flyer on him. If he is healthy, we obviously know he's how good he was. I don't see it happening. You know, it's just another guy in the mix for that fifth starter. You're definitely not going to see him come out of the bullpen, but I'd be surprised if we see Santana play a part on this team in almost any way.
This is a bit of a long shot, but it kind of reminds me of the Vladimir Guerrero situation from a few years ago.
Yeah.
Where they kind of just took a flyer at the guy. It was not the same player he once was.
It doesn't hurt. I mean, especially when you look at that fifth spot, you're looking to fill it with young guys.
Yeah,
for the most part, to have a guy like Santana around isn't a bad thing.
And he's a known good teammate. And I think Josh Tolt played with him in New York, and he was talking about how important he was and how good of a guy he was in that clubhouse. And
but Josh Tolt might not be playing with him.
That's the problem. Yeah. But he hasn't pitched since 2012.
Yes,
and he's got a bad shoulder, and he's not going to be ready for the start of the year. So, yeah, it's definitely a flyer. There's not much downside to it.
It's a big name, so we're going to talk about it. But outside of that, I don't know.
He's a 2-time Cy Young winner. I think whenever you bring a guy like that, you're going to talk about him. But
and he's a slot baller now. He doesn't throw even 90. He throws from the left side. And yes, the changeup is great. I mean, it was what made him great. But if you're not throwing 90s, it's difficult.
I mean, you traded for a guy like Marco Estrada. That's the guy I want to see in the fifth spot there. Or maybe even Daniel Norris. Sanchez I like in the bullpen. But for me, like, I'm almost thinking now, you know, could Santana get in the way of those guys' development if you're trying to push him into that role?
I don't know. I think what it does, and you knew that the bullpen was an issue you needed to solve, it solves it kind of by proxy. If he's in your fifth spot, you can move Sanchez into the bullpen.
Okay.
And you can do a full year of Sanchez in the bullpen, which I don't think is the long-term goal, is to have Aaron Sanchez in your bullpen, but it certainly solves a short-term need. You look at the way this bullpen stacks up, it is definitely in need of at least one more power arm, and Aaron Sanchez doing a pretty good job of it a year ago. When we come back, all the Raptors were lousy last night. One of the worst first quarters I think I can safely say I've ever seen this team play, and by the numbers, it was a record, a franchise
record.
It
was the worst.
As far as shooting percentage. They've lost four straight. They're likely to snap that streak tonight, though, so that's good. But it doesn't get a whole lot easier in March. We'll talk about it coming up next. I'm Ben Annis, along with Dave Zarum and Jeff Simmons. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. Raptors get annihilated by the Warriors, 113-89. That almost does them a service because they they outscored the Warriors 32-15 in that fourth quarter. I mean, this game was never a game. Right out the chute, the Raptors got outscored 27-11 in the opening quarter, scored a lower shooting percentage in that opening quarter than they ever have. Any quarter in the history of this franchise has not been as bad as the Raptors shot in that first quarter yesterday. Have you ever seen anything like that, Dave?
No, I mean, they shot 5%.
That's difficult to do.
1-for-19. I mean, it's unheard of.
Now, there weren't a whole lot of open shots, though, that they missed in that first quarter, to be honest.
Yeah.
And a lot of that you can put on the Warriors' actually outstanding defense, because we think of the Warriors as being this offensive juggernaut, the Splash Brothers, and hitting all those threes. Mm-hmm. They're also one of the best defensive teams in the league.
Their offense gets the attention because it's just so prolific and dynamic and fun to watch, and because in years past that was the book on them, this great offense, but you know, they also give up all these points. But this year, what's making them so good, I mean, they're the best team in basketball, and it's not even close. Memphis is kind of sneaking up behind them, but what makes them so good is the fact that they have the best offense and the best defense. You know, they hold opponents to the lowest field goal percentage of any team in the NBA, so they're really doing it on both ends of the floor, and that's just a juggernaut. I mean, it's a tough spot for the Raptors because you're heading into that game on a three-game skid, really looking to turn around, but the way Golden State plays, I mean...
Well, what does it say about the Cavs, then, that they destroyed them the night before?
Listen, the Cavs, you know, the Cavs are the next team the Raptors are going to face at home. They get to play, thankfully, New York and Philadelphia, but then they come back home and they have to play the Cavs, and the Cavs are the hottest team in the East. I mean...
Yeah.
You know, but also at the same time, it took 42 points from LeBron to beat the Warriors, and the Warriors were on an off night, too. So I think those are two teams that I would be surprised to see both those teams in the finals, but they're two class teams, let's put it that way.
The Raptors right now not playing like a class team. No. Four-game losing streak, the longest of their season. Now, it's likely going to end tonight because they play a horrible Knicks team that went to overtime, actually, last night as well.
Yeah.
In a weird game. Double overtime, I believe, actually, against the Pistons.
Yeah. And they won.
Which is really weird.
And
so
Bargnani had 25
points. And Andrea Bargnani had 25 points.
So they won one. I mean, what are the odds they win back-to-back? Not very high, I would say.
Well, the thing is, too, you would hope, and I wrote this heading into yesterday's game, just after the three games, you would hope the Raptors come out with some real kind of incentive to bring it, you know, especially after last night.
Well, and you would have thought that would have happened last night.
Exactly,
they were well-rested after that long four-game road trip coming out of the All-Star break. They were getting a Warriors team that was just in a brutally difficult game against the Cavs the night before. But you couldn't come out of the gates any slower than the Raptors. And you know what? Even when they're winning on occasion this season, this team has difficulty in that first quarter for whatever reason.
Yeah, remember earlier in the season, it was the fourth. You know, they kept kind of coming on strong late. The worry thing to me last night, and I'm not anywhere near, you know, ready to push the panic button or anything like that on the season. I mean, this is kind of what happens over an 82-game stretch. There's still, 16 games over 500. So I'm not too concerned about you know, the long-term, the big picture with the team. But heading to last night, you needed to see them come out of the gate strong. And the fact that they did the complete opposite, they came out of the gate as cold as they've ever have, you know, in 20 years. That was the really kind of disheartening part of it all.
And there's been times this season where we've talked about Lowry and DeRozan being one of the better backcourts in the NBA. Now, we saw the best backcourt in the NBA last night,
sure
I think.
Did.
And Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. But, Jeff, yesterday, Lowry and DeRozan were 5 of 23 from the field. They were horrible. That first quarter, I mean, a lot of that was on them. They didn't make a field goal. The only field goal made was James Johnson, I think, hit a little, you know, mid-range jumper in that opening quarter, and there were some free throws made, what have you. But it's been those two guys in this four-game losing streak that have not produced. And Kyle Lowry was pretty vocal and harsh on himself in practice the other day, called himself trash. Is there a legitimate concern there, Jeff, for this team and how that backcourt's played?
Yeah, there's been some warning signs all week. It started in the New Orleans game where they just blew up in the fourth quarter and lost to a team without Anthony Davis. And then last night, they just kind of gone away from their strength. They're not really moving the ball like they were when they were at their best. And DeRozan isn't moving the ball at all. And it seems like some teams kind of had the book on them. I think, Ben, you pointed out a tweet earlier today when apparently on Golden State's board, they kind of had figured DeRozan doesn't move the ball. He's just, and they rely on too many one-on-ones. And that's not a successful way to play. And you watch the team like Golden State who moves the ball so well. They've kind of just gone away from their strengths, and you just see a different attitude around the team.
And yeah, when you're two best players, your two best scorers, your two main guys, when they're both ice cold, I mean, it's not going to bode well for your team, and it's a big reason why the Raptors are struggling so much. And then to compound it, you know, those guys are trying to find their groove again, and so they do so by maybe forcing up shots that everyone knows they shouldn't take, but it's the kind of thing where you see one go down, and suddenly, you know, the basket looks bigger to you, you know, that kind of thing. So you see DeRozan and Lowry taking some bad shots, going a little more ISO than we'd all like them to, just because I think they're trying to find a way to turn things around. But, you know, until one or both of them do, you know, the Raptors are going to be hard to find success against good teams.
Do you know how many assists that starting five had yesterday, the
Totally.
Raptors?
I feel like you do.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Why would I ask a question if I didn't know? Yeah, I do know. One. They had one assist that entire starting five all game. Now, of course, they didn't play much in the second half once. Yeah, it was
Lowry only played, I think, 18 minutes last night. But still, that speaks volumes. You know,
he didn't have it, by the way. James Johnson had it.
Yeah, of course, yes.
Yeah. So that's, I mean,
what
that's
a weird game.
That's concerning. Yeah, and Jeff, you mentioned it. I mean, the word is out on this team. And I feel like it's not all season that they've reverted to this one-on-one hero ball type team, but when they're at their worst, that's what they are.
I think when they get desperate, they go into that mode. And, you know, and that's, you'd really like them to just stay with what got them there, you know, which, like you said, Jeff, is ball movement, you know, sharing the ball, that kind of like Atlanta Hawks type of thing that we saw earlier in the season. And I think it's going to take a big night from one of those guys to realize that again. You know what I mean? I think they're going to keep forcing it up until something changes. And I you hope that comes soon.
Yeah, the outlook of the last four games might change a bit. If they win that Pelicans game, you end up 2-2 on the road trip. And it's not as dire as it is right now.
Well, really, you had that huge win against Atlanta after the All-Star break. Yep. The Houston loss is I don't say forgivable.
It's a back-to-back. Thank you. It's a tough one.
That's one you could live with. But then the New Orleans loss and the Dallas loss, those are two ones that you just gave away at the end. You should have won both those games. Warriors, we talked about how good they are. So, you know, again.
And usually the first game home after a road trip is tough, too.
And it was like their like eighth city in like 10 days or whatever. That's not the number, but
body clock.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, again, I don't think a lot of people expected them to win last night, but you expected them to at least bring it given that they had just lost three straight in that fashion. And that was what was so worrying. Also, like going back to DeMar DeRozan, we've stopped seeing him go to the line during this stretch. You know, he's averaging like three or four trips to the free throw line a game over his last four or five games. And that's such a big part of what he does. It really changes the dynamic of the offense, of the team, of the way opponents have to guard him. So there's a lot that the Raptors are doing differently than what they were doing before. And, you know, they're struggling as a result.
Yeah, it's not good right now at all. It was interesting to see Patrick Patterson in the starting five yesterday. And again, if you go to Twitter, there were a lot of people calling for that. I don't know if it's ever going to happen again. The way you start that game yesterday, yeah. I mean... Is there a scenario where Dwayne Casey goes back to that, Dave?
Yeah, maybe if Amir Johnson's hurt. I mean, it's not Patterson's fault why they did that, but yeah, you're gonna think that Casey's gonna go back to the way things were before. Anything to avoid having 12 minutes like that again.
I wonder if Lowry's trash ability recently with and by the way, I know this isn't on TV. I just did the air quotes.
By the way, you ever wonder why athletes don't say anything interesting in scrums or don't want to say anything?
We sit on it for like 3 days.
Yeah, because they say one like minutely interesting comment, and it's like every question they get for the next 2 weeks is about, oh, what, you said you were trash. Are you really trash? And then Casey has to talk about it. All the other players have to talk about
it. Why do you think Kevin Durant hates scrums so much?
Oh my God, I understand it. Yeah, I relate.
I don't know. I think it's kind of funny. I think it was clear to anybody. It was tongue in cheek. But he was one of seven yesterday. And, I mean, you look at the numbers, he has, I mean, trash is a little on the extreme, but since that All-Star break, save for the Atlanta game, right, it's been tough. I wonder if there is some correlation to him, for the first time in his career, not getting the full All-Star break, which is now longer than ever before, where All-Stars actually do get a break after the game as well as the non-All-Stars get more than a week off. But he had some time to settle down, you would think. I wonder, though, if being a part of that is draining some way on him, Jeff.
Yeah, everyone was pushing him on Twitter, and my whole timeline was flooded for months, and I personally couldn't stand it. But maybe that's starting to backfire on him, and he was carrying a lot of the load when DeRozan was out, and you saw him starting to wear down a bit before the All-Star break, and he was really busy during that stretch.
You know, I don't know how much of it has to do with the All-Star break. I think what it has to do is the guys around him are struggling. You know, everyone's shooting poorly. Lou Williams is shooting poorly. DeRozan's shooting poorly. And I think just his personality, his role in the team, he thinks he has to take it upon himself to kind of bring them back.
So are they forcing it?
Which leads to forcing a lot of bad shots just to try to do something. Same for DeRozan.
I can't stop looking at this Bargnani stat line last night. took 20 shots, and he was 25-12. I've been staring at it the whole time.
Yeah, look out for tonight. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, sure, yeah.
He had 12 rebounds.
I'm going to call it right here. He's going to go for 40.
Wow.
Revenge game.
Well, who else is on that team right now?
Quincy Acey.
Yeah. All right. So there's a bunch of former Raptors.
He'll go for 30.
Quincy Acey was starting earlier this year. I don't know if he still starts with the Knicks.
Jose Calderon.
Yeah, I think he does. He's one of their better players.
They are just littered with former Raptors. Yeah, so the Raptors have the Knicks in New York tonight. And then it's another difficult stretch after that. I wonder if there is a scenario, guys, at the conclusion of this season where Dwayne Casey, I mean, this team has played so poorly and there's so many bad warning signs that Dwayne Casey is not back a year from now. Is there a scenario in your mind? Is there something that could happen? The worst case scenario where Dwayne Casey loses his job.
No. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying before.
Lose every game and then get swept in the first round.
No, then they'll promote him in that scenario. No, I don't think they're going to. Listen, again, it's an 82-game season. You know, you're 16 games over 500. You're number two in the conference. You got your division locked down. You got a home court in the playoffs locked down. I don't think they're going to lose every game from here on out. I think, again, it's an 82-game season.
Definitely not the Sixers.
What happens is you have your ups and downs. And, part of it is, like, we just don't know how to relate to this in Toronto to a degree. I think, especially with the Raptors, to be on a winning team in this situation, it's easy to forget that, you know, save for, like, the 96 Bulls, like, teams, even good teams go through these bad stretches. And I think that's just where the Raptors are right now.
They're not in a good stretch. But they are still second in the Eastern Conference. But nipping at their heels, just a half game back, those Derrick Rose-less Chicago Bulls and Cleveland closing fast as well, just one game back. But in the fifth spot is now the Washington Wizards, who are playing a little bit more like the Washington Generals recently. They've lost six straight. They lost back. Thank you. Lost back-to-back games, 1-2 Minnesota, and last night to the Sixers. I don't know if things can be any worse for Washington. Now, I used to think that finishing fourth would be a death knell for this Raptors team. It would be the worst thing in the world if they finished fourth, because you were guaranteed one of Chicago, Cleveland, or Washington. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like for a while that would be horrible. Now, already, before Washington was as putrid as they've become, the Raptors have owned them this season.
Yeah.
But now that Washington has some serious problems, now, again, they don't have Bradley Beal right now, who's been in and out of the lineup all season long, but the way they're playing, the way the Raptors have owned them, first of all, they might not finish fifth because Milwaukee's now just a half game back of them.
Yeah.
I mean, is finishing fourth the worst thing in the world? So that could, you know, in a couple of weeks, the Raptors could very easily be fourth.
No, and like you said, I mean, it's completely changed from that perspective because of the way Washington's fallen off. I think we can all agree Cleveland's not going to be in that fifth spot. I'm interested to find out, though, like Ben, like if they get Chicago, is that a team you're still scared of without Derrick Rose?
I think so.
Me too.
I think that's still a bad matchup for the Raptors. I mean, Derrick Rose has had one of his better games of the season against the Raptors early this season.
Yep.
It just seems like there are certain matchups that don't, for whatever reason, the Raptors own the Clippers this year. Clippers are a good team, but for whatever reason, the matchups favor the Raptors. Maybe it's their superior bench to the Clippers. Whatever reason, the Raptors beat the Clippers. The Raptors beat the Wizards. Those are two teams you'd take your chances if you're the Raptors any day of the week.
They're also 3-1 against the Atlanta Hawks. It's
right.
Kind of hard to gauge.
But Milwaukee could be a bad matchup for them.
That's a good point. I mean, they played them tight all year.
Jason Kidd had their number last year.
I think Milwaukee's a team that they would crush in the playoffs, but it would be close, you know. So maybe they wouldn't crush them. I guess that doesn't make any sense.
You just swung in two very different opinions.
I think they would crush them, but then they would also lose. No, Milwaukee would be a tough matchup. You know, I think Raptors would still be on top. But Chicago does still scare me. And obviously Cleveland is just like, they're looking like they're going to turn into a behemoth come playoff time.
Rose might have been their, fourth best player this year?
Yeah. And he was
Dean Butler and
the Derrick Rose we used to know.
Gasol.
Yeah, there's a lot to still play out here as we go towards the end of the season. But and in the NBA, I don't like to, but it's just a reality of the regular season just not meaning a whole heck of a lot. We usually know the best teams. We know who has a chance to win the title day one of the regular season. This is kind of one of the weirder NBA seasons I can remember, and maybe it's just a sign of the times and the change in the NBA. First of all, I think it was LeBron James who said, in the Western Conference, there's no seeds. It's just eight teams who can win it all. I totally agree with him. And in the Eastern Conference, now I guess maybe there's a little more clarity with Cleveland. I don't know if you could find too many people who would say that the Cleveland Cavaliers aren't the best team in the NBA, despite Atlanta and despite their continuing to win, despite a couple of road bumps here after the All-Star break. But it seems, Dave, more than any other season I can remember, the regular season is important this year in the NBA.
Yeah, standings are. It's also, by the way, it's been a really fun regular season. It's been a lot of really great
Amazing.
Games. Yeah, some just seeing players come into their own and the Russell Westbrook show. I mean, there's just a lot going on.
You're kind of shocked when you look at the schedule and there's like a lame game in the Western Conference.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just it's been such a great season for the NBA. But yeah, the jockeying for position, especially in the East, has been pretty fascinating to watch. And I don't think we're even close to seeing it shake out. I mean, talk about the Indiana Pacers. You know, they're going to be getting Paul George back in 2 weeks, potentially.
They're a playoff team right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's looking more and more likely.
10 games under 500, playoffs.
Booyah. And then they still have a top 10 defense. You bring a guy like that back, maybe climb a couple spots in the standings, and then suddenly that matchup, maybe even if you get an Atlanta-Indiana matchup, that's going to be riveting. So, yeah, there's so much stuff to watch for right now in terms of playoff positioning, and I don't think we're anywhere near seeing kind of the final standings, especially in the East.
There's a lot to be decided for this team, not just this year, but in subsequent years. And it's going to be a big offseason just this year.
You're talking about the Raptors?
For the Raptors, yes. No question. Amir Johnson's a free agent. Lou Williams is a free agent. There's going to be decisions to be made by Masai Ujiri. I think Lou Williams has kind of put his name into this discussion to get a big raise. Amir Johnson, who knows? He's one of those heart and soul type players for this Raptors team who seemingly plays through injury every night. I don't know if he's had a night where his ankles aren't in some serious pain and he takes tumbles and you wonder how he gets up, but he does.
Yep.
I don't know if he's a starting big man that you want on a championship caliber team, but we'll see what happens this offseason. Where do you see Masai Ujiri going with this team? Is this the year, if this is just a year in the development of this team, is next year the year where you start assembling the pieces and looking forward towards making that next step and becoming that championship style team?
Well, I think they have a lot of the pieces there. I do think, you know, JV, DeMar, Kyle, these are really substantial pieces and all locked in. You know, JV's got an extension coming up at some point, but for, as far as DeRozan and Lowry goes, I mean, they're locked in at bargain prices, comparatively speaking. But yeah, you're heading into this summer with more cap space than you've had in a long time. When you talk about Lou Will, Amir Johnson, Landry Fields, Chuck Hayes, all those expiring contracts, it's gonna give Ujiri some options. I think the key is, I'm kind of with you. I think Lou Williams has played himself into the conversation as an important piece going forward. But the thing with him, and Amir Johnson for that matter, it's all going to come down to, you know, the asking price. You know, at what cost do you bring back those guys? Lou Williams, are you willing to pay more than $8 million a year for him? I mean, to me, that's kind of right away where I'm comfortable.
It's a different landscape, too.
With the cap going up?
Yep. Upcoming CBA renegotiations, right?
So, yeah, and that could affect things, certainly. But both Lou Williams and Amir Johnson are guys who, if at the right price, I definitely think they should be coming back into the fold. Amir, for all the reasons you listed, I mean, whether he starts or not, he just brings you so much. He's a classic, you know, doesn't show up in the box score kind of guy. And he's kind of front and center in the whole tone of this team, if that makes sense, the whole kind of mojo.
You got money to spend. Fields comes off. Camby's money comes off. Hansbrough comes off.
Yeah.
So you got money to give these guys raises, right?
Yeah. Tyler Hansbrough looked like he cared a little bit last night, too. Getting in a bit of a shoving match.
I love that, by the way. I mean, like, if
Dwayne
that guy,
Casey loved it.
Yeah, if that guy had a blue and white Maple Leafs jersey on, like, everyone would be going crazy for him today. How he was trying to bring him back into the game, trying to do whatever it takes.
The scrappy white guy.
Exactly. But you know, he's a guy who, he's a bit of an enigma. Because, I mean, I think he does good things on the floor, but he's also pretty maddening to watch at times. But, you know, in his role at 10 minutes a game or so, you know, I think you need a guy like Tyler Hansbrough around. He's such a, especially like in a playoff series, he's just a big distraction almost for the other team, if that makes sense.
What the hell is Terrence Ross? He was a guy that
he's a basketball player. He's a human.
Yes. Other than that, though.
That was deep.
He was 7 of 14. He actually had a good night last night in garbage time.
Yeah, it's hard to be too you know, excited about that, but he did lead the team in scoring, didn't he?
Sure he did with 18
Somebody
points.
Somebody had to.
He was 3 of 8 from 3 and 7 of 14 overall from the field. He's no longer a starter. He can come off the bench, but he's had some really cold nights coming off the bench, too, and hitting those threes that he used to be so good at in the corner. And we're all waiting for that development where he drives the basket a little bit more, and it just has never come. We know he has the hops.
Yeah.
It's just for whatever reason, it's never manifested itself.
You know, heading into last night's game, his last seven games, Terrence Ross was shooting 18% from the floor and 22% from three, and that's in 18 minutes a game. That's
not good.
No, it's not good. You know, but a conversation I was having, and I kind of wrote, touched on a little bit in a piece on sportsnet.ca, and I talked to Alvin Williams about it. Okay, let's pretend Terrence Ross was DeMar DeRozan, and this is year three of DeRozan's development, and DeRozan's playing on that team. You know, in DeRozan's third year, the Raptors were a crappy, crappy, crappy team. I think they were 23 and 43, something along those lines. And DeRozan went through some really cold spells, as all developing players do. But nobody really panicked because, I don't know, you had the luxury of time to let this guy develop, let him play through that. Now it's a different situation for Ross. You know, I don't think the Raptors saw themselves being in this position, but here they are. They're a winning team, deep playoff aspirations, and suddenly you don't have the patience to deal with a guy like Terrence Ross when he goes cold. And I wonder how much of that plays into it in terms of the, you know, his name being brought up all the time in trade talks and everyone asking, you know, what are we supposed to do with Terrence Ross? This might just be a young player going through, you know, hitting a bit of a wall and going through that stage of development where you kind of have to rediscover your game and figure out exactly how what you're going to do to go forward. So I don't know if we should be panicking about Ross or not. I mean, you can. I think you can make a pretty decent argument on either side of that.
And it's a tough spot for them at the big picture because they don't really have a guy who can do what he does. So
yeah,
a lot of people are calling for him to be traded, but then who fills that role, right?
And we've seen how valuable he could be. I mean, think of Game 7 of that Brooklyn Steel series. Yeah, I mean, he's the reason why Lowry had that opportunity to win the game at the end. So we've seen what he can do on both ends of the floor. We're not getting it right now, and I guess you have to be concerned whether he turns it around or not and how much drive he has.
He was pretty brutal early in that series, though.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Who knows? I mean, how much – you've spent some time around the team, him, Dave. How much of this do you think is mental with him? He seems like a little bit of a fragile guy.
Listen, I talked to him. So, you know, he got taken out of the starting lineup this season when they played Milwaukee. And the game before that, they were against New Orleans, and he had played 10 minutes in that game. It was a season low. And I spoke to him the next day, and I was just kind of asking – I was speaking to him about for a piece on Valanciunas, but I couldn't help but asking, you know, like – what happened yesterday, you know, well, you know, how do you deal with that? And he was like really frustrated by it. And he was just, I don't want to say confused, but he just kind of said, you know, like that's how it is sometimes with this team. You don't know when you're going to play. You don't really know when you're going to get your chances, and you just have to kind of learn to deal with that. And you can tell he was a bit like, he was out of his comfort zone. You know, it was a case last season where he knew he could play through his mistakes, and now he can't, because like I said before, they're you know, the goal is winning, and if he's not going to bring it, Casey's going to pull him as he did and put someone else in there. So I think he's having a hard time dealing with just that kind of pressure on him that hasn't been there before.
No, definitely hasn't. Before we move on, Bruno Caboclo still now with the mad ants of the D-League.
That's a bit of a mess.
It's a bit of a mess. And I talked to Tom Stirner, assistant coach, last week on this very radio station about it. And, yeah, it's not an ideal scenario. He threw out the idea of the Raptors having their own D-League team.
That's been discussed a lot, yeah.
How awesome would that be if a D-League team, if you could go down and watch Bruno Caboclo play at Rico Coliseum?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you think there would be a bunch of people that would go, and maybe Bebe Noguera would be down there too? Who wouldn't want to go see those Brazilian dudes play down at Rico?
Yeah, or have them play at like the Ryerson gym or whatever. I mean, that'd be really cool. It would let people who are priced out of Raptors games be able to go and check that out.
Which has now become a thing the last couple of years.
Yeah, totally.
There's
no more Sprite Zone. It's not cheap. I mean, they're selling out every game. So if you want to go the scalper route, you're paying, you know, triple value, whatever. So the D-League thing has been tossed around a lot. And I think it is a legitimate possibility because, you know, you see Caboclo go down there. The reason you send him down is to give him minutes, right? To get him experience on the floor. And he goes, he plays like 3 minutes in the first half, 0 minutes in the second half in his first game down there. I mean, he's not getting any better by going to the D-League, so you got to find some sort of alternative.
And there's, I think, 10 different teams.
I think 12 with
12.
The Mad Ants, yeah. So what the hell is that? Yeah, like.
And there's some interesting guys in that league, too. I mean, it would be fun watch to watch it.
The D-League is a fascinating story. That's like a great magazine piece that needs to be written.
There you go.
I hope maybe my editors are listening. But hopefully
nobody that's your competitors listening.
Yeah, fair. Good point.
The Mad Ant story is going to go
point.
Crazy.
But the whole thing about the D-League is this league where everybody who's there wants to leave. You know, that's the goal of everybody there. Coaches, the water boy, everybody. They all want to get up to the NBA. So it's this weird scenario where, yeah, it's a big opportunity for guys, but all anybody wants to do is get the hell out of there.
Do the water boys get called up?
I don't know if it's happened before, but it might.
But there's too many teams. Who are the water boys working for?
I don't want to spoil it. I got a screenplay in the works. I don't want to mess it up.
Mad Ants. They got some good team names in the D-League.
The best. I mean, well, the worst, but.
The worst.
Technically the worst, but they're the best.
And you look at some of those box scores, guys are chucking down there.
Yeah.
And the point guards are chucking assists. Like, they're selfish with their assists.
You want to know who's killing it in the D-League this year?
Who's that?
He's had a triple-double. He's had, like, 25.11 assist games. No. Mike James.
Yeah?
Mike James. Mike James at 40 years old is killing it in the D-League this season.
Good for Mike James for wanting to play, I guess. But
can't keep Mike James off the court.
No. Is he still writing stuff for us now?
No, but he might be involved with some projects down the line.
That's an interesting dude. I mean, who wouldn't want to see Mike James come in as a visiting player to go play the Toronto Toros or whatever they're called?
How about this? Player coach.
I love the idea. I'm glad we figured that out. Coming up next, we'll talk a little bit about some of the NFL news that's broken the last couple of days, including the draft combine, Josh McCown signing a 3-year deal with the Cleveland Browns. Lions cut Reggie Bush. Is he a bust? Is it fair to say? I mean, he's had some pretty good years. We'll talk about that and maybe get into the A-Rod stuff as well when we return. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Jamie Doyle.
Were you unconscious when you were in the water?
Yeah, I drowned.
That's pro surfer Maya Gabeira talking about the time she almost died trying to set a record riding the world's biggest waves. She's not joking. Gabeira was crushed under a 70-foot wave off Portugal, breaking her leg and leaving her blacked out face down in the pounding surf for over a minute. But she's not too serious either. Not for someone talking about how the culmination of years of training and determination came within a heartbeat of killing her. Even while still in intensive care after the wipeout, Gabeira said she was happy to have surfed that wave. So if you've ever wondered what it takes to surf big waves, to ski impossible slopes, or to jump off a mountain and try to fly, that's what it takes. You put in the work to get very, very good at what you do and accept that every time you're out there, so is death. And if death comes for you, well, so be it. At least you had one hell of a ride. Fortunately for the 99% of us who don't live on the edge, we can live vicariously through the adrenaline rushes and near-death experiences of the men and women who play 15 of the world's wildest and most dangerous games.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network, I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. If you wanted to watch fat guys run 40-yard dashes, last week was your week. So you got to watch that at the NFL Combine in Indianapolis. And you got to watch athletic guys do it as well.
Hey, let me toss this out there. If we were to do a Combine right now, Jeff, Ben, what would be your events? What events would you have locked down?
I don't know. I feel like I don't have hops. I feel like, although if it's just us three, I think I could probably outjump both of you.
No. Forget the competition. Just like, what will you put up your best numbers in?
The shuttle runs. Okay. I don't know.
Nice. Wunderlich test? You know, Wunderlich test?
Yeah. Do they do that at the combine too?
I think they do it.
Yeah, I'd do well in the interview.
Great answer.
I'd do well in the interview.
Is there an eating contest?
As long as they don't ask me if my mother's a prostitute. Yeah, I think I would do well. We'll talk about the combine and Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota in just a second. But let's start with some of the news of the last week in the NFL. Cleveland Browns, we know their quarterback situation, I guess, is not ideal. Johnny Football still involved. To what degree, we're not sure. A lot of that will be decided in the preseason next season. But Josh McCown at least is in the mix now. 3-year deal with the Cleveland Browns. Is this something, I mean, is Johnny Football looking over his shoulder now, Jeff? How does this impact his future?
Well, I think it's just insurance for him, and they don't really know what they have. Last year was such a mess for them. And
What happened to Hoyer?
Hoyer's a free agent, and this signals he's not coming back. He's going to maybe go to another spot he can start.
Because he played pretty well, didn't he?
Yeah, he was pretty good, but his limitations kind of came up at the end.
Okay.
But with McCown's more of a locker room presence and probably kind of a guy they want around Manziel. But I think it was pretty telling that he chose this job over Buffalo, who was after him also. And if you want to go play for a team with no receivers, no tight end over Buffalo, who has pretty decent players around them, it must mean that he's probably in line to start in Cleveland right away. I don't know how crazy the coaching staff is about Manziel. And
would he have been in that scenario in Buffalo?
I think he would have had to compete a little more.
Yeah.
I think it's just more of a clear path. He got pretty good money from Cleveland, $5 million a year for a guy who's hasn't really done much other than been a pretty reliable backup.
Yeah, and he's part of that McCown lineage of backups, perennial backups.
There's two
the
of
NFL.
Them.
Yeah, so it's pretty good lineage, like I said. Johnny Football, though, this is a huge offseason for him. Is this a make-or-break type of offseason in just his second year in the league? We know NFL careers don't last all that long, although if you're a quarterback, they last longer than if you're a running back or whatever. But if Johnny Football comes out of the gate and plays, I mean, he could not have underperformed to expectations more than he did in his limited time in the NFL last year. He looked horrible, 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 horrible. And you have the stories that continue to come out about him not, despite saying that I've matured, I've changed my ways, I'm going to rededicate myself to football. It never happened. If he comes out of the gate again and the stories continue and he doesn't perform, and it seems like, again, he can't adapt to the pro level. I mean, could you see the Browns cutting bait on him this season?
I don't know about this season, but you're right. A lot of he was horrible on the field last year. He didn't play that much, but the problem with him was almost off the field. And there were stories with him coming late to practice, and there was the big story with him, he didn't know the playbook. And that was kind of worrisome. The work ethic came
just a little.
Yeah.
And
that's a big playbook.
Yeah, the NFL's hard. College is a lot easier. You can go to party and then show up the next day. And the NFL, it's a really complex system. And playing quarterback requires so much of your time. And there's not a lot of Michael Vicks and Brett Favre who can kind of maybe more Vick than Favre that can kind of – Vick didn't even read the playbook. That was part of the problem. But with Manziel, like, his immaturity, and it's kind of become like the tale of what you don't want to be. And the story you heard of the combine is – kind of that Eddie Haskell, you guys know the reference, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he kind of tricked everyone. I'm growing up. I'm going to be smarter. And as soon as he gets the money and gets drafted, he reverts back to form. And he's having his teammates out to parties, not caring. And then when he comes in to start at the end of the year, he just looks completely ill-prepared. He was horrible.
I don't mind it, though, if he understands that his NFL career, he never had a future anyways. And if he just tanks it again this year and then ends up in a broadcast booth in 3 years and has the millions of dollars. Millions of dollars, and then is upfront about it. I kind of respect that.
They call that the Tebow.
Yeah, but
without
Tebow,
the partying.
Tebow was
actually,
I think, trying to have an NFL career there. And Tebow won a playoff game. Let's not forget
Tebow.
Right.
He had his moment.
His overtime pass that might have been a bit lucky, but
I mean, there's a ton of red flags around Manziel. I mean, I guess the only thing in the positive column is the fact that he is so young. It's so early in his career. So it's just a matter of when you pull the plug. You know, I'd assume they're going to give him a little bit more.
And he does have an arm, right? I mean, everybody talks about the legs. He's got an arm. And at last year's combine, people are kind of blown away about his accuracy.
Like, listen, I didn't see too much Texas A&M football when he was around. But when you see the way Mike Evans has been playing on Tampa Bay, I wonder how much that had to do with Manziel's numbers. I mean, again, like I'm admitting I might be way off here, but to have that target, I mean, that may have, you know, boosted his Manziel's value a lot.
Yeah, no question. And the system he played in and his ability to outrun everybody. I think a lot of quarterbacks, a lot of college players realize that you can't get to the edge in the National Football League. You can't outrun linebackers anymore, where you could almost everybody in college. Yeah. Also this week, the Detroit Lions cutting Reggie Bush, who was former second overall pick, and remember how much of a big deal we made about the Texans taking Mario Williams over Reggie Bush in that draft? Ended up being a pretty good call. Now, Reggie Bush is, I'm going to pose the question here, and it's a relative question. Is Reggie Bush a bust? I mean, he has a pair of 1,000-yard rushing seasons in his career and a pretty good receiving back as well. But coming out of USC, playing alongside Matt Leinart, I mean, he was expected to be a transformative NFL running back, and he's a guy that was cast off just this week. Jeff, if you look back at the career of Reggie Bush, it's hard not to say that it's been a disappointment where expectations were back in that draft in 2006.
Yeah, I think I'd call it disappointment rather than bust.
Yeah.
Because, look, the next pick after him was Vince Young. I think that's more of a bust.
What?
Or Matt Leinart, or a guy who didn't really get it. Bush had some pretty good
season. Matt Leinart kept falling down that draft.
Yeah, he's still in the top 10. Mm-hmm. And Bush had some pretty good years. He was pretty good in Miami a couple of years back, and he won a Super Bowl in New Orleans, and he had some good years, but he was never the dominant, transcendent player that he was in college and high school.
But I wonder how much of that was circumstance. I mean, because didn't he, in New Orleans, wasn't it a platoon back situation? So he's going to be diminished a little bit statistically?
They like to use three running backs, and they like to kind of move him around the backfield, kind of how Darren Sproles was used the last couple of years. But his dominant speed really never showed up consistently at this level. And what Ben said before, it's a lot easier to get to the edge in college. Mm-hmm. And at USC, those teams were powerhouses that he played on. Those were all-star teams, and Pete Carroll's kind of done the same thing in the NFL.
They were well paid as well.
Yeah, he was well paid.
Yes.
Yeah. For good reason, by the way.
Yeah.
As he should have been.
Yes.
No, but he's had a pretty decent career. Like, the average career for a running back is 2.5, 3 years, and he might still get picked up in a situational role, and he's been a pretty decent player for, 8 years now?
Well, that's the thing, too. Like, with running backs, the window is so much smaller. I feel like if you can get 3-4 really good years out of them, then that's almost the best case. Not a best case scenario, but, you're happy if that's the case. And he's had, before last season, he had 3 seasons of 1,000 yards rushing. I mean, take it for what it's worth. They were on losing teams for the most part, but he has performed, maybe you have this notion of a guy who's the second overall pick, but I don't think his career has been an overwhelming disappointment.
We'll have to see where he ends up. It'll make news no matter where he ends up, but bit of a rough year last year, injury hampered, no question. So mentioned that the NFL Combine continues, and all eyes will be on the 2 big-name quarterbacks that hooked up in the NCAA playoffs this season. Jameis Winston of Florida State and Marcus Mariota of Oregon. Now, all of this could be posturing, and you never know until draft day shows up, but teams like to throw different things out there and leak certain stories to increase their potential to draft the guy that they want. But everything we're hearing, and I guess if you're the Bucks, I don't necessarily see the reason to mess with this, because you're going to get whoever you want no matter what at first overall. But it really does seem, Jeff, like Jameis Winston is going to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He's going to go back to Florida, where he was a star at FSU, and they're going to put up with whatever that off-field stuff is. And if you want to talk about Johnny Manziel's off-field stuff, we can joke about that, right? There's some stuff about Jameis Winston's off-field stuff we can't joke about. It's not funny. It's serious. But apparently the Bucs are satisfied enough with the conversations they've had with him that they can put that in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, and if you talk to people around the league, you won't find one who doesn't think that Winston's going number one at this point.
Really?
Haven't the Bucks even said, we're willing to build around this guy? Or
yeah, but league? I think they would have said, I think they're just trying to keep the value of the draft pick up.
Fair enough.
But Winston's one of the most fascinating draft prospects, even more than Manziel, just because of how much his game just projects to the pro level.
Yeah.
And also the downside potential is massive. Mm-hmm. With the off the field, they're gonna be spending most of their time on the off the field stuff, because the on field stuff, he threw at the combine, which is pretty rare for one of these top quarterbacks, and he looked incredible. His deep ball was, he surprised a lot of people with just how comfortable he looked, and his personality. He's just such a loose guy, and he's kind of cocky and arrogant, which some people like. But all indications are it's him, and unless they find something like you mentioned that comes back that off the field stuff, it seems like he's the guy, and Tampa Bay feels comfortable.
But weren't Marcus Mariota, weren't his numbers at the combine really surprising as well?
He's a fast guy.
Yeah, the thing with him is he threw really well.
Yeah.
And the thing with Mariota is he comes from a gimmicky kind of scheme in Oregon.
Yeah.
Like in the NFL, unless he lands in Philadelphia, he's going to have to take the ball under center and play in a pro-style offense. And Oregon is nothing like a pro-style offense. So he took like 5 snaps under center last year. And in the NFL, pretty much everything's under center, unless you're running totally out of the shotgun.
Do we still think he's going to be a top 5 pick?
Yeah, I think so. Quarterbacks are kind of so dearth with the bad teams.
Yeah.
All these teams are there that most of them need quarterbacks.
Who's picking 2 this year? Tennessee?
Tennessee, and they're in a weird spot because they took a guy late in the 6th round who is kind of a pro-style passer, but it's not very intriguing. Zach Mettenberger.
Yeah.
The coaching staff has kind of put their support by him, but if I'm them, you kind of need a quarterback. They kind of had no building blocks.
Well, and the Eagles you mentioned, that could be an interesting team that could make a play for Mariota.
See, that's a team that you have to watch. And you even see some of the writers talk about they're convinced that they're going to move up.
And they have trade assets.
Yeah, they can give up future picks. They have a pretty good roster. And if they can move into the top 5, that's the guy they're targeting. Chip Kelly loves the guy. He coached him in college. And they don't really have a quarterback. Nick Foles kind of fell off last year. Mark Sanchez is a free agent. And he fell off down the stretch. And that's the one thing holding that franchise back. And if they can get a guy like Mariota, who the coaching staff could put, they already know the offense around him, I think they'd be willing to move anything they could to get up to that spot.
Yeah, it seems like Chip Kelly knows what type of quarterback he wants. He knows what style offense he wants to play. And Marcus Mariota might be a guy who could, you mentioned it, other teams, he steps in, he has to learn how to play that pro-style offense, how to take the snap under center, how to call different plays, how to audible out of different plays. He's never done that in college. But if Marcus Mariota goes to the Eagles, it's a pretty seamless transition, you would think. Gents, thanks a lot for this. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun.
When I come back, I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today. We'll talk to Mike Wilner, more Blue Jays talk, and Johan Santana chatter. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jeff Simmons and Dave Zarum. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.